Hello, my name's Ben Harmon and I'm the director of Stills. We're a charity and centre for photography based in Edinburgh. To learn more about our work and to find out how to get involved and support us, please visit stills.org. You're listening to Photography Down the Line, a podcast aimed at sharing the ideas of artists, photographers and other people we're in touch with from the photography sector. For this episode, I had the privilege of talking to Marilyn Stafford about her incredible life and work. Our conversation coincided with the publication of her monograph, A Life in Photography, published by Blue Coat Press in 2021. Thank you for listening. Hello, am I speaking to Marilyn Stafford?
Yes, you are.
Marilyn, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
I got a series of questions that I'd like to ask you, and I should point out to listeners, first of all, the timing of this conversation is largely to do with the publication of a new book called Marilyn Stafford, A Life in Photography, published by Blue Coat Press this year. And it's widely available now via your website and via Blue Coat Press. The first question I had, Marilyn, was asking how you, the circumstances in which you started taking pictures.
Well, it depends on which period you're talking about, professionally or before professionally.
Right.
Prior to becoming a professional photographer, like most children in the time I was growing up at any rate, the families would have a little box brownie camera. And so everybody took pictures with a little box brownie camera. And I was looking through some of the prints that came back from those ancient days, and they're so beautiful. They're all printed on a little white card, glossy, with a design all around the edges, which it was so beautiful to receive. Anyway, I did start taking photographs just simply with the family brownie. I remember becoming inspired one day, because there was a difference between taking a photograph of mama, papa, friends, and all that, and something that inspired you to want to go further. And that was a day we were having a picnic with the family, and we were sitting by a stream. It was a very, very clear stream, and the water was running over some pebbles, not very deep. And I felt very moved. And I decided just to step into the stream and take a photograph with my box brownie, which I did. And when I got the photographs back, it was water running over rocks in a stream, and didn't have the emotion that I felt. So I abandoned any thoughts of further taking photographs as such, and simply went on with my life. Now, my life as a child was to be an actress. I had been selected amongst my school chums to represent my school at a formation of a children's theater at the Cleveland, Ohio, USA, playhouse, which was what was at the time considered off-Broadway. There was a big movement in the United States to decentralize the theater from Broadway. And all over the country, there were what was called community theaters. And the Cleveland Playhouse was one of these. And at one point, they decided to have a children's theater to train young people, eventually, if they wanted to become part of the adult company. And so I was selected by my school to represent the school at this thing. And we were, I would say, probably 50 or 60 youngsters all meeting in this local theater, and we all had to walk up on the stage and say one line. And the one line was, and everybody had the same line to say, bring that man to me. Every one of us had the same line.
Yeah.
And amongst these kids was Paul Newman.
Wow.
And Joel Gray, and quite a lot of other people who became known in Hollywood as actors, producers, directors, whose names probably wouldn't be very well known now. Mm. But they were, it was an interesting group of people. And so for many, many years, I must have been about 10. So until university, I was part of what they called the curtain pullers, which was the children's theater.
Mm.
And we had private classes as well as group classes. And we studied the Stanislavski method. And so I now think of myself as probably the only Stanislavski photographer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Stanislavski, of course, taught you to observe in order to create a role.
Mm.
At any rate, my great ambition as a youngster then was mainly in the theater. And when I went to university, I was also involved in theater. So the camera didn't enter my life until much, much later.
Mm.
And it was, again, through the theater, because after university, I went to New York to try my luck on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And met many, many people, as one does as a young person. You touch different artistic communities. And one group of people I met were documentary filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very instrumental in opening my eyes, because they invited me on visits to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which had a beautiful, and still does, I'm sure, documentary film section. So I saw at this early stage, my eyes were opened to documentary filmmaking, which conditioned me, I am sure, in my still photography, because I never wanted to be a cineast.
Mm.
But I did think that the documentary was important, because within me is a natural love of telling stories.
Mm.
And mm. telling stories with documentary approach is the direction I went into.
Yeah.
So it was those early days that were the biggest influence. Mm. And it was through this group of documentary people who were making a film on Einstein that I was able to meet him.
Mm.
This was post-war America.
Mm.
Many things were going on at that time, politically, and from the atomic warfare recognition. And they wanted to do a film about Einstein making a statement against the use of atomic bombs.
Right, following Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. And so they invited me to join them, which I was very happy to do. And I was presented in the back seat of the car on the way with a 35 millimeter camera, which I had never in my life seen before, and told that I was going to take stills on this film, because there were only three of us. There was the director, the producer, and me.
Mm.
And that's really how I started taking photographs.
Right.
I suppose you could say that I started I broke my, what do you say, broke my teeth on Einstein, which is bad, you know. And but I always think to myself, I started big with Albert Einstein and ended pretty big with Indira Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
And in between, lots and lots of people, street kids, important to me as who they were, but not world shattering.
No.
And that was the beginning.
Yeah. Really. Yeah.
But it wasn't to me a real beginning in the sense that I didn't think of myself as becoming a photographer.
Mm.
And at the time I had a woman friend, and I believe one of the questions you asked me is how I got to Europe.
Yes, yes, I'm curious about that.
And I have to tell you, it was because of male infidelity. Because my best friend's husband was found out by her to be having an affair. And she was not going to have any of that and confronted him with it. And he sadly said, go home to mother while I sort myself out. Well, she wasn't going to have any of that either. And so she said, okay, you want to get rid of me while you sort yourself out? I'm going to Paris. You're going to pay for it. And I'm taking Marilyn with me, and you're going to pay for her too.
Right.
And that's literally how I got to France the first time. Mm-hmm. And as they say in the United States, after you've seen, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after you've seen Paris? And so once I got to France, I realized that I really would like to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also a rather nasty time in the United States. It was the time of McCarthyism.
Right. Yeah.
And it was frightening. You couldn't say anything of a positive social change nature for fear of being clamped on the shoulder and hauled off to the committee.
Mm.
And so it was nice to have a breath of fresh air and to start a new life.
Mm.
Which is exactly what I did.
Was Paris at that time, we sort of know, it's easy in retrospect to think of Paris as this incredible center of the cultural world, but is that how it really was at that time? Was it an incredible draw?
Well, I'm not sure. One never knows.
Mm.
I found it very eye-opening, mind-opening, heart-opening. It was a wonderful experience in the beginning for me. When I decided to remain, I found a little hotel room on the Rue Monsieur le Prince, not far from the Luxembourg. Mm. And I also wanted to do some photographs. I don't know why, but I already had this Rolleiflex camera from the States. And I thought, well, maybe it would be good just to see what happens.
Mm.
And so I would go up to the Boulevard Saint-Germain, where there were many, many buses going to different directions. And every day I got on a different bus and went to the end of the line and would get off and take photographs wherever I landed. And I landed in some very, very interesting places.
Mm.
And most of those photographs are now in the book that I have just published.
Yeah.
A lot of them are. I did land one day near the Bastille and found a little kind of alleyway, which enticed me like going down a rabbit hole almost. And I walked through this little passage and found myself in what had been a huge, beautiful Edwardian development, but was now a gigantic slum. Mm. And nobody was around except kids. Parents were probably working, and just the kids who weren't going to school. It may have been the time of year. I can't remember exactly, but they were walking around pretty sleeveless, so it may have been warm. And I just kind of had this big Rolleiflex with me and just walked around. And of course, kids, they see a camera and a woman with a camera right after the war. Mm-hmm. They started following me. And I took a lot of photographs of them and later learned that this big slum was notorious, absolutely notorious for the fact that there was no water in the buildings, you know, in the apartments. There was no toilets, of course. And they were either one on the landing or outside. The walls were painted with lead. Mm. People were sick. And this one time beautiful, beautiful Edwardian development was now just desolate. It was awful. Mm. And recently, I met a professor at Brighton University, Dr. Julia Winkler, and she became very interested in these photographs and researched a great deal. She actually was doing her thesis at the time on neighborhoods. Oh. So she was finding it interesting to use this material, some of which she did. And she managed to find a young person who, well, he was no longer young. He was retired, but he had been a young person at the time I was photographing. And she interviewed him, and I've talked to him. And it is so marvelous, the memory that children have.
Yeah.
He must have had a happy home, because as far as he was concerned, lead walls didn't matter.
Mm.
No toilet didn't matter.
Mm.
It was a happy, happy life. And that was so beautiful to know.
Mm.
And we are all still in contact. Now, Dr. Winkler brought this exhibition, made an exhibition of my photographs, which she made part of her thesis, and she took to Toronto to the Alliance Française.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very big exhibition there of the photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And her partner, who is a filmmaker, made a short documentary film, which is available to be seen
mm-hmm.
on this whole enclave of buildings and people.
Right.
And I have a couple of little books which were printed out. I'll send them to you.
Mm.
If you send me your address,
you.
I'll send you the a couple of the things she's done, because they're very interesting. Of course, her academic approach is different from my approach.
Mm.
And she found out many things that I never knew and didn't really care about. All I cared about was the visual and what I felt coming from the youngsters who I photographed.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, just one day I went there. That was one bus stop, the end of the line.
Yeah, yeah.
There were quite a few others.
Yeah. And some of these pictures appear in the new book, don't they?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed. And there's a piece written by Dr. Winkler, and also There are contact prints as well as photographs in the book.
Yeah, it reminds me, because your book was published by Blue Coat Press, and they've, of course, done a few titles on the work of Tish Murtha. And it's a very different place in a different era, but it reminds me a little bit of her photographs of young people in the northeast of England, showing great resilience and playfulness, despite all the odds that you can see around them.
Well, I suppose unless one is maltreated or sickly, as child, if you have the love of your family, that's all you need, really.
Mm. Marilyn, how did you come to meet Henri Cartier-Bresson? And he became something of a mentor, is that right?
Yes, he did. That's a kind of long story. Do you want to hear the whole story?
If you don't mind, yes, please. Yeah.
Well, I have got many angels on my shoulder. And an awful lot of synchronicity in my life. And when I went first to Paris, I had to go to London to visit some friends of friends in New York. And I took a ferry boat from France over to England. And I had with me, because everyone in the United States assumed post-war England, everyone was starving. I had a big suitcase with a side of bacon attached to bring to my hosts. And I bought a bottle of brandy to give them as well. And I was on the ferry boat speaking to somebody, and alongside me came a rather round Indian gentleman wearing a khaki vest and a khaki cap, but right into my conversation with this young man and started talking to me. And as we got talking, I asked him what he did. And he said he was a writer. And I said, oh, could you help me? Because I have a list of books that somebody in New York wants from England, which are Penguin books and can't be bought in the United States because of copyright. Where can I get them? So I showed him my list of books, and he said, oh, they're all mine. And his name was Mulk Raj Anand, and he was an Indian writer writing in English, one of the early few. And of course, we became friends immediately. There was no question about it. And as we went through customs, my bottle of brandy was taken away, and I had to open it and scratch the label because customs thought I was going to sell it. And so Anand and I had a good stiff drink and saw each other again in London. And he became my dearest, most wonderful love and friend until he died at the age of 95 in about 2004. And was the person who introduced me to Indira Gandhi, who called him Chacha, which is uncle, and Uncle Mulk. And he was very, very important to me, both emotionally and from a work point of view. And he had met Cartier-Bresson when Cartier-Bresson went to India.
Ah, yes.
And they had become very friendly. And one year when Anand came to Paris, he introduced me to Cartier-Bresson.
Right.
And that friendship also became a very nice one. Anand had a sweet Indian paternalism about him. He had a daughter, and everybody he met, he would say, when I'm gone, when I'm away from London, please go and visit my daughter, see how she is, keep an eye on her. And so he did the same with me. And he said to Cartier-Bresson, I suppose, keep an eye on Marilyn, which Cartier-Bresson did, and which was very sweet of him. And he invited me to his house. He was married at the time. I think it was a flat. And he was married at the time to an Indonesian dancer whose name was Ratna. And I had quite a few meals prepared by Ratna at their house. Mm-hmm. And he would invite me to go out on the streets with him while he was shooting.
Yeah.
And I kind of tagged along with my horrible big Rolleiflex while he towered over me with his little tiny Leica.
Mm-hmm.
And as a mentor, was very silent. He never said, do this, do that. If I showed him a photograph and asked him what he thought of it, he wouldn't say, I like it or I don't like it. He would say, were you to do this to it, crop it or whatever, you would get this kind of feeling. If you did it another way, which he would point out, you would get another kind of feeling. So it was a very subtle way of saying things. He never said you must do anything anyway. And so I would be invited to go with him out on the street. And of course, in a sense, I was a kind of a decoy, because there I was, tiny, I only 5 foot, a woman at a time in France, with a camera, a big one, when nobody had cameras post-war. And so it was, he just went on his merry way, and I tagged along watching how it worked. And he worked very quietly. I remember one day we were sitting at a table in a cafe, and I was sitting at the table to his right, and he had the camera in his lap. And as we were talking, he just very quietly lifted up the camera. He didn't hold it to his face. He just lifted it off his lap, snapped the photograph, and went on talking. So he knew his camera very well, obviously. And the photographs in my book that I have of him were the only ones I really took of him.
All right.
Which I'm sorry about, but I also felt I mustn't impose too much. And so he invited me to join him while he was shooting at the Grand Palais in Paris. There was an art ménager exhibition. That is domestic appliances. Sounds better in French. And he was shooting, and I shot him a couple of times, which was the only time.
Right.
But those photographs are in the book, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I've seen one of them on your website, which I should at this point out to people. It's marilynstaffordphotography.com, and there's a lot of pictures on there and information about your life and the photo award, the photo reportage award, which I'd like to come on to. But I just wanted to ask about, I don't know where to start really, all these people you photographed, Edith Piaf, Italo Calvino, Le Corbusier, were a lot of those commissions for newspapers?
No.
No.
Not at all.
Not
really. When I was living in Paris in the early period, I had to earn a living. And I literally sang for my supper doing so at one point. I was having dinner with some friends in a restaurant, and it was one of their birthdays. And we were all singing happy birthday. Mm-hmm. And at the end of our song, I noticed there was a gentleman behind me, and he knelt down and said, "I am a impresario, and I'm looking for a singer for an ensemble. And I heard you singing, and I would like to know, would you like to audition?" So ever onward, I said, "Sure, why not?" And I did audition, and it was with a most wonderful ensemble at a very, very chic dinner club off the Champs-Élysées called Chez Carrère. And it was the only club in Paris that Princess Elizabeth at the time was allowed to visit when she came to Paris with her new husband. It was a dinner club. It wasn't a cabaret. And it did have, however, a very large dance floor. And every once in a while, there would be attractions that played there. And as it called for very important people to come in to dine, there were always celebrities there. And I remember one night, Jean Gabin was there, and he was invited up to sing. So he just got up from his dinner, sang a little song, and that was the cabaret, if you will. But a lot of people went there. Many, many people went there. I mean, it was so chic and so elegant. And the gentleman whose ensemble it was is called Leo Choliac. And Choliac was also a very fine musician and composer. And he wrote many songs for Charles Trenet that are very well known.
Yeah.
And at that club would come in very important people because it was that kind of a dinner club. And it one night, Eleanor Roosevelt came in, and she was with her son, Elliot. And very kindly, hearing me sing with my ghastly American accent in French, invited me to her table. And that's how I met her. And years and years and years later, met her grandson.
All right.
And we are in great correspondence. And he very kindly has written a piece for my book.
Oh,
his name is Ford Roosevelt. And I asked him if he would write something because he had made a comment about the photograph. He had contacted me through an article he saw about me and asked if I knew his grandmother. And of course, when I look at my book of regrets, whose photograph do I regret not taking? Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, my idol.
Yeah.
And that is one of the sadnesses of my life. that I never did photograph her. Great woman. And so I sang for my supper, as they say, for about a year, during which time an American singer came in and joined our ensemble, and his name was Eddie Constantine. And Eddie was translating songs from French into English. And he brought some of his songs along to Edith Piaf, who was singing up the Champs-Élysées at the Casino de Paris. And she flipped over him, and they became lovers. And so every night after she finished work, she would come into our club with her entourage and pick up Eddie to take him home to breakfast. And she invited me to come along. And she had just bought a house in the Bois de Boulogne and was redoing it from top to bottom. So it was quite a surrealistic thing to look at. And in the basement, there was a very, very long table, a wooden table where everybody sat around because there were about a dozen of us for breakfast. Among them, Charles Aznavour, who was part of her entourage and became a very good friend of mine, very nice young man. And after breakfast, we would go into a little room off the kitchen where she had built a shrine in memory of her great love, Marcel Cerdan, who was a Moroccan boxer, and he had got killed in an airplane crash. And following his death, she went to Morocco and spoke to his wife and said, "I loved your husband, you loved your husband. I want you to come with me to Paris so we can mourn together." So Marcella Cerdan was one of the people sitting around the table with her two children. And after breakfast, we would all go into the little shrine room and she would light some candles to Marcel Cerdan. Wow. Which was very beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you ask me, why didn't you take pictures?
Yeah.
Had I even broached the subject, I would have been out of there. But I wasn't even thinking like a photographer then.
No.
So it didn't matter. But I did photograph her when we went to tea one day with Eddie and Charles to the Grand Hotel in Paris. And I just asked her, "Do you mind if I take a photograph of all of us, you know?" And she said, "No, not at all." And I like the photograph of her, which is in the book, which is smiling and wearing a white dress, because she always looks very depressed and unhappy and miserable wearing a black dress, because that's her persona. Or was her persona.
Yeah. But presumably you wouldn't have been carrying your camera around with you everywhere at this point.
Not at all. No, I wasn't. I have a kind of awful one-track mind, so that I didn't even think of taking photographs. I just had a camera.
Yeah.
And it was only once I started being a photographer that I started thinking like a photographer,
and
looking at things in a different way. It's obvious that I was looking and seeing photographically anyway, but I wasn't recording it, unfortunately.
Yeah. But I think Cartier-Bresson passed some of your pictures to The Observer. Was that around that time? And then it became, photography became the thing you did more than anything else?
This was in 1958, and I had already married a British foreign correspondent who was living in Paris, and I was, I believe, 5 or 6 months pregnant. And the Algerians, who were, Algeria was a colony of France, and they were fighting for their independence. And many of the French were strafing the villages. And many of the villagers were seeking refuge in Tunisia over the border. And at this border, there was a Red Cross hospital. And because the Algerians were also sending their wounded over there to rehabilitate, the French bombed the border. But they also managed to bomb a Red Cross hospital. And this became an international incident.
Yeah.
And the press was flooding into Tunisia to do stories on this. And nobody was mentioning all of those poor Algerians who were strafed out of their villages, who were sitting in refugee camps. Nobody talked about them. And I had been aware of so many displaced people following World War II. It was awful to think of this massive migration forced of the Algerian people, who were very poor villagers. And so I asked my husband if there were any way I could come down. And because he was on the spot, he said, you know, it was safe to come. And so I made contact with the Liberation Army, who took me in a car to the border. And I had said to them, I hope that the roads will not be too rocky because I'm pregnant. Oh, no, 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 no problem, no problem. But of course they were. And I had to spend 6 weeks in bed on my return because my child was very eager to get out. And at the border was this refugee camp. And I did take these photographs.
Yeah.
One of them in particular, I call my Madonna. And it's a portrait of a refugee mother with a little baby.
Yeah.
And I was so moved by her. When I got back to Paris, I went to see Cartier-Bresson with my photographs because I didn't know what to do with them. And he very kindly made a selection, sent them to the Observer in London, who published two of them on the front page. And they were my very first front page. And I was, and still am, very proud of it.
Yeah.
And the Observer also sent somebody down to do a story about the refugees. Whether they got help, I don't know. But I feel I did the little that I could.
You must have felt, being pregnant yourself, that Madonna and Child image you mentioned.
Could have been me.
Yeah, you must have felt incredible empathy with...
Oh, terrible. Yes, absolutely.
And interestingly,
my daughter became a midwife.
Oh, really? And that's really, in those pictures, you can really see how important it is to you that the emotional, what's going on emotionally in the, with the subject you're photographing is so important to you. It's what was missing when, from that picture of the stream you took with the box brownie when you were small, that the emotional content and being able to tell that story.
That's true, except I did feel very emotional about about those pebbles and the
right.
water.
Yeah.
So I just don't know. Maybe it was the wrong subject matter.
Yeah. And the book that's just been published goes up to, is it about 1983, where the pictures, the date of the pictures in the book more or less stop? Am I right?
Yes, because I had been able to earn my living in photography in London when I came in 1960 by photographing for some American newspapers and for international newspapers, magazines, British, international. And it was a time when everything was beginning to get digital. And it had taken me a lifetime to figure out depth of field, depth of focus. For me, new technology was an automatic rewind that you could attach to the bottom of your camera.
Yeah.
So when this big new technology of digital cameras came in, I just thought, I cannot learn another technical thing, not with my brain. And so I thought, no, I will retire. But I did go on to make a little video for children. I wanted to make a series of videos for children. And I was given a grant by the Commission for Racial Equality. And the idea of it was to show the different immigrant communities in England and tell stories for children from each one of these communities, with the ultimate underlying aim of showing that people are not that different. And we are all really human race, and we shouldn't hate each other. And to this end, I had a thought to do creation stories. And I did a series of creation stories. I had a lot of assistance, really. The Commonwealth Institute in London was wonderful. And I was able to use a lot of their facilities and some of the people from the different communities I was able to contact through them. And I did put together about five or six of them, but when it came to the crunch, nobody wanted it. So it's tucked away
right
in a box.
Yeah. But you have gone on to found your own photo reportage award.
Yes, I have.
And that's in its fourth year, I think. Is that right?
I think we're going into the fifth year now.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, the idea of the award is based on my having been a single parent photographer and trying to earn my living in not only a male-dominated profession, but also with the limitations put on my activities because of having the child. And as I didn't have a lot of money coming in, I had to find ways of taking care of her when I was working. And it occurred to me that probably I was and I'm not alone in this, that there are many women in the same kind of domestic situation.
Yeah.
But not only that, even without a child, women who are very good photographers, who have stories to tell.
Yeah.
And because of my feelings about wanting to make the world a better place, if that doesn't sound too pretentious, which is something I've always wanted. I met a remarkable young woman called Nina Emmett, who runs an organization called Photo Document, photo spelled F-O-T-O.
Mm-hmm.
And her aims are the same as mine. And so with her collaboration, I was able to set up this award for women. And every year, around International Women's Day,
yeah,
we announce the winner of the previous year and open up
yeah.
to the following year. And so this will happen on International Women's Day this year.
Yeah.
And the first year, I was really very fortunate because Olympus was very gracious and gave me some funding.
Yeah.
And I was able to pay an international panel of women who became judges.
Yeah.
And to pay the award. The first year's award went to, interestingly enough, a young British woman working in Delhi,
mm-hmm.
who was in her spare time going to Kashmir and taking photographs of people who were suffering from post-stress disorder.
Right, yeah.
And the aim of the award is to show a problem.
Yeah.
And a problem which is either in the process of being addressed or could be addressed, and how it might be addressed. And she had been going to Kashmir off and on from her job, off her own back, to take the photographs to show what was happening in this situation. And she won the first year's award and said that the money allowed her to pay a driver the next time she went, who not only took her around, but also protected her.
Yeah.
She has gone on to become a rather successful photographer too.
Mm.
The second year was a young woman from Turkey. And she was photographing Syrian girls who were sold in marriage by their families in order to survive, both family and girl. And another year, the award was won by a Russian photographer living in London, who yearly went up to the North Pole to photograph work on climate change. This year's winner was a young woman who did work on seeds. And it it gives me such joy and pleasure to see these people have great talent and to at least lend a helping hand, you know, to maybe just pay somebody to take care of a child if they need that, or just to pay the driver, whatever they want the money for, it's theirs. Yeah. But it's to work on a project which needs to be addressed, a problem that needs to be addressed or is being addressed, how to do it or how it's being done.
It's a fantastic opportunity. And I know from looking on your website, the previous winners are all on there with information about their work. So yes, people can find out more about it. Yeah. Marilyn, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time. You've been listening to my conversation with Marilyn Stafford about her life and work. Since recording the episode at the end of 2021, our correspondence has continued and Marilyn has remembered more fascinating details about some of the events that she's described. For example, she spoke about carrying a suitcase containing a side of bacon and a bottle of brandy between Britain and France, and has since remembered that the suitcase also contained clothes she was asked to pass on by some former members of the American International Brigade who had voluntarily fought in Spain against the rise of Franco and fascism. For those of you that might be able to attend, a retrospective exhibition of Marilyn's photographs will be held at Brighton Museum and Art Gallery from the 22nd of February to the 8th of May 2022. Photography Down the Line is a podcast aimed at sharing the ideas of artists, photographers, and other people we're in touch with here at Stills. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more or subscribe for free via Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and other providers. Thank you so much for listening.